Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus.
Makalua.
The Man Team.
Mega Bears Fan.
Also, I figured out how to find the live link. You just click on Polycast Recordings Live on the polycast.net. I don't know how that still works because I don't think that link is still active the same way, but apparently it does.
It must be the correct link.
All right, so we're up. All right. Hello, Internet, and welcome to episode 406 of the Polycast. I am one of your regular co-hosts, Mega Bears Fan, joined as always by Canis Albinus.
Lots of video uploading and trying to figure out how to make YouTube do the right thing makes a Polycaster go crazy.
And our other co-host, who is hopefully not going crazy in the Shining sort of way, the Mian Team.
Another day, another city. And I'll have you know that I was never seen in the first place. Therefore, I am not going crazy.
I'm sorry, I meant to say the Shinin. You know, we don't want to get sued.
Oh, right. Although,
we'll be fine.
Although if we want to talk about crazy, I don't think you can actually pinpoint a time I went crazy. I think I've always been crazy.
Hey, you're stealing my line.
We are all on the continuum of crazy. Somewhere.
True.
I'm on like five continuums. I'm tired. I just want you could probably plot my position on a five-dimensional chart, but what use would that be? We couldn't visualize it anyway.
You heard it here, listeners. Canis is literally string theory.
That's 11 dimensions, but anyway, we will
We can only plot up to five, though.
Oh, we can? I thought we could go up to 11.
No, we can't. Maybe someone can. Not us.
Oh, right. I see what you're getting at now. Okay.
Tra-la-la-la-la.
This week, I want to say, what was the date? August 1st, Civ Meyer's Civilization, at Civ Game, the Twitter feed for the Civilization games, posted a graphic which stated that 84,721 rockets were launched to Mars in July. And the immediate response from everyone in the comments and everyone on the forum was, Beyond Earth 2? Beyond Earth 2? Is this a secret drop? And,
Well, the little tiny bit of extra context is that the description, or the actual text of the tweet said, we love seeing so many of you go beyond Earth, with beyond in lower, with a lowercase b, so.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's more of a reference than a drop that they are planning Beyond Earth 2, though.
Yeah, it's a callback, not a tease.
Yeah.
And
I don't remember Beyond Earth being set in Mars either.
Well, it's because in Vanilla Civ 6, the victory condition for the Science Want victory was getting to Mars instead of Alpha Centauri. Yeah. And then they changed that in, I want to say, Gathering Storm.
Correct. But then again, you know, just to be pedantic, Beyond Earth also does not take place on Alpha Centauri because, copyright.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in Civ 5 and all previous Civs, you're always going to Alpha Centauri.
Yeah, no, I know.
And I will give my opinion. I wish that we could have a Beyond Earth 2. I think it's a little bit late in the cycle for them to announce a new game, though, unless they're expecting it to come out sometime next summer.
Yeah, I think for like Civ 6, the announcement was sometime in like March or something like that, and the game released in October.
For the most part, they will announce a game, at least Firaxis in the history has released announcements 6-ish months before the game comes out. And usually the game comes out in either like 2 months from now, like in October, or it'll come out in like, when did Civ 6 come out? I remember Civ 6 was the oddball.
No, I think Civ 6 was in October, because I remember it was around my birthday, which is in October.
Okay. So maybe it was the expansion packs. Like, I know the expansion packs came out at a different time.
The the expansion packs, I think, were released in like the spring, like April-ish or something like that.
All I remember is we heard about Gathering Storm and it was coming out 3 months later. And I was like, what? That's very fast.
Yeah, it was a pretty quick turnaround.
Not that that's a problem, but it just brings up what would we would assume that they would build Beyond Earth 2 in the Civ 6 engine, because that's what they did with Civ 5 and Beyond Earth 1. What would that look like? Because what districts would a city in Beyond Earth have?
I'm sure you could make things up if you needed to.
Well, I mean, for one thing, you'd probably have a lot of just the similar archetypes. You'd want your science district. You'd want your, you know, trade and commercial district. You'd want your industrial district, a cultural district. And then, you know, you'd probably have some sci-fi districts as well.
I can imagine the world project things like the Exodus Gate stuff. And is that what it's called? I think the Exodus Gate I think the Exodus Gate might be from a different franchise, but there's like the Purity Gate and the Supremacy Gate and the Mind Flower. I think those could be presumably considered to be district project type things, like the spaceport.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Especially you know, considering they could have is a compliance district.
Oh no.
Or we could also call it the District of Truth, where the nerve staples are.
We don't need nerve staples. We want
it's
the
not
game.
A matter of need.
We want the game to be PG, not PG-13.
I could see there maybe being like they could, you know, if they were to maintain like the miasma mechanic, you could potentially see maybe a district that like removes miasma within a range instead of
or utilizes it.
Yeah, in some way, you know, provides yield for it and protects units that travel through it, as opposed to it being something that you remove with workers or whatever, especially if they continue to use the builder paradigm instead of workers, because there's a lot of miasma on the map. And oh my gosh, could you imagine having to build enough builders to clear all of that miasma?
I don't remember.
You just
clearing...
make another unit for it too.
I don't remember removing miasma with workers. I remember using miasma clearing and satellite stuff.
Oh, maybe that was the way it worked. I could be misremembering. It has been years now since I played Beyond Earth, so
I actually reinstalled it a couple days ago. And have been meaning to play it, but I haven't gotten to it yet. Beyond Earth was a game that I really liked. I just wish that it wasn't a one-off. Like, I wish that the things that we learned from Beyond Earth were utilized in Civ 6. Like the diplomacy system, for instance. The war score system was pretty neat, too.
Yeah, that was one of the...
I remember.
Diplomacy was one of the strengths for Beyond Earth, which is a rare thing in any Civ game for diplomacy to be one of the stronger aspects. It was just kind of too bad that so many of the AIs in that game were just kind of passive pushovers.
Well, they're kind of that way in regular Civ 2. In Civ 5, I mean. Because at the end of... Like, they said before Gathering Storm came out that the Gods and Kings AI, which was the one that was really aggressive toward the player and actually made you worry about getting attacked a lot, they said that that was more aggressive than they wanted it to be. And then I remember in Beyond Earth, and it's still this way, or not Beyond Earth.
Brave New World.
Brave New World, yeah. Getting my Civs mixed up. I remember it being almost like, the AIs aren't even here. What are they doing? Why aren't they bothering to stop me?
Part of that was a mechanical thing, too, because there were so many mechanics in Brave New World that encouraged, you know, peaceful cooperation and trading. Like, all the trade route stuff, which provided reciprocal benefits to both, you know, trade partners, meant that once you started trading with someone, it's like, oh, well, we're getting yield from this trade route. So, like, let's not ruin a good thing.
Yeah. My issue with that idea is the ever constant, well, the train just left the station and I wasn't on it. Darn it.
Anyway, yeah.
That also still had the problems of disincentivizing successful conquest on top of that. So you'd have to like make the AI properly evaluate when the penalties it would take would be the juice not worth the squeeze. It's not a good environment generally, but certainly the nuance of that would not be easy to get the AI to correctly evaluate. Unless you just give it bonuses so it plays a different game, which on high difficulties would be the case, but
I think that's what they do there anyway.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they do that in every Civ, because AI huge numbers of bonuses that allow it to do things the players can't get away with.
Yeah, I personally would be very surprised to see a sequel to Beyond Earth, considering that the reception to the first game was very lukewarm at best. But, you know, it could happen.
They sold enough to make an expansion pack, though, so...
Yeah, and I do wonder, though, if there were plans to make a second expansion that ended up getting shelved because the first expansion did not do well. I don't know how well Rising Tide did. So I wonder if there was plans to do a second expansion because, you know, all the other Civ games have tended to have two expansions. And there was definitely a lot of potential for a second expansion. I've said in the past, I think it should have been called Falling Skies, and it should have focused on doing more aerial combat, air units, and more stuff going on in the upper atmosphere and maybe even in space with like the rest of the solar system. So like more stuff in the satellite layer and maybe even like, you know, asteroid mining or somehow exploiting other, you know, planets and moons in the same star system.
That would have been brilliant. I don't think I've ever heard you say that before, actually.
I've written it several times in my blog posts whenever I talk about Beyond Earth. But yeah, my personal hope was the second expansion would be called Falling Skies, because I thought that would be a real cool inverse of the first expansion's title.
Yeah, it was so close.
Yeah, it was not to be.
I don't think there was a planned second expansion because Civ 6 came out when it did. It would be very odd for them to have... like pushed up the development of Civ 6 that fast, because Beyond Earth Rising Tide came out, I want to say, in like, it was another one of those fairly early in the year releases.
Was it 2015?
No, it was I think it was 2016, actually. Let me look.
Wasn't Civ 6 2016?
Nope, it was October 2015. So yeah, it came out
not, so 16.
1 year before Civ 6 came out.
Yeah, so there probably were not plans for a second expansion.
Probably not.
But like I said, there was plenty of room for one. Like I said, I think further developing all of the, you know, air units and doing more stuff with the satellite layer and, you know, like I said, maybe beyond would have been, you know, really, really cool.
Make the victory conditions a little bit more engaging instead of it just being like, oh, you built the mind flower, now survive for 30 turns.
Right. Oh, well.
We can always dream.
And who knows? Maybe they really are working on it.
It's possible. But I think we can move on to our next related topic.
Well, it's related insofar as it's on Twitter. Maybe other than that, I don't know. But anyway, I rejoice those of you playing Civ on Xbox. A console-side patch was issued that improved the launcher. No, I'm just kidding. You get less crashes, which is actually beneficial to gameplay. So it should crash less frequently on Xbox.
Oh,
there's some questions about the PS4 crashing, but... Not doesn't look like that's in this tweet.
I realize why you said that, because I forgot to put the forum link that was attached to that tweet. Basically, no. There was a forum thread that was posted when that came out, and it was asking, is it related to the way they figured out how many people got the number of space rocket launches? Like, maybe there was an unknown exploit on the Xbox that somehow caused them to have either extra difficulty or maybe too much access, and they realized it when they went in and looked at how many people won the science victory.
I see. So there was some history tie-in there.
Yeah.
I was just not privy to it. Well, that's interesting.
Well, it was a single post on Civ Fanatics, so
yeah.
Take of that what you will. But why would Firaxis spend the effort to make a patch for Xbox patches and... Uh-oh. Can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I just got a notification on my phone that my internet died.
Uh-oh.
That's an interesting theory.
Yeah, I don't know how that could possibly be. Anyway.
Well, I guess we'll just continue unless...
Well, if I drop out... Just stop the show and wait for me to come back, because okay. I'm the one recording, so.
Oh, yes, that would be unfortunate.
I did just verify we are still live as of a few seconds ago, so.
Yeah.
Okay, that is very strange. Anyway, I was saying something and I forget what it was. Darn.
It was along the lines of crashing less on console.
Oh, yeah, if I've played the Switch version... It's pretty crashy. I mean, it's not as crashy as I've heard that some of the other consoles are, but it has its problems. So if they're going to make a patch to fix Xbox, why wouldn't they fix the other consoles too? And why wouldn't they update the PC to fix its crashes?
I mean, unless there was an Xbox specific issue that was causing crashes.
Oh yeah, like an Xbox software update that requires games to be updated to match it. That's possible.
Yeah.
Because I know that a lot of times you'll see, oh, every game in my Steam library needs to be updated. Oh, it's like a 5 kilobit patch from Steamworks. Okay.
Yeah. Which is nevertheless still scheduled for some reason.
Because that's the default for how Steam does things.
Yeah.
It's fine. I'd rather it be that way than...
Yeah, I guess it's not hard to install a patch of that nature.
Yeah.
There you go. You won't get no crashes, just fewer. But you will get fewer if you're on Xbox.
In the thread for this topic, they were suggesting that the patch may not have even happened yet, which I don't know how that could be.
I don't know. I've never touched Civ on console.
And we have one more news topic.
Yes. So moving from the present and future of Civilization games to past Civilization games, a user, Blake00, has apparently started a petition on the Civ Fanatics forums, well, a link to a petition on the Civ Fanatic forums, to ask Good Old Games to add Civilization 1 and 2 to its library of games, because apparently they are not available digitally anywhere. So unless you have a disc for Civ 1 and 2, you cannot play it.
At current time, the easiest way to get a hold of Civ 1 and 2 is to buy Civilization Chronicles, which came out between Civ 5 and Civ 6. And that was the thing that I was talking about digging out of my closet a while back. And I subsequently did that, and it is now on my... So yes, Civ 1 and Civ 2 are in that bundle. All the DLCs, the expansion packs are included. Except I think Multiplayer Civ Edition. Is it Multiplayer Civ or Multiplayer Gold? Either way, they don't have the multiplayer enabled in that version because GameSpy is gone. So.
Oh, yeah.
But Blake00 is the guy who did the large scenario hunt for older games recently, if you remember that topic we did a while ago. He also was the one who did that video for Civ 1 that talked about all the mods. We covered it on the show. I don't remember if anyone remembers it.
How long ago?
I checked the Good Old Games site in question when I was doing research. And one of the things that they do is they have this big list of games, and you basically just click on the ones you want them to bring, and it adds a vote to it. Unfortunately, there are multiple different entries for some games. You're likely to find more than one place where Civ 1 and Civ 2 are mentioned, and you'll find the individual expansion packs sometimes, and sometimes all of them put together. So if you're diligent, go through the list and upvote every single place where it's listed. Also, there's a small piece of news that I'm adding here. Polycast Season 1 will soon be available on the YouTube channel, which up heretofore it has not been. The audio quality is pretty bad, but remember, this was back in the time before podcasts were even a thing. So think 2006, 2007 era podcast. But it will be on the website, on the YouTube channel soon. Introduce the next topic. Wow. So somebody on CFC, let me open the name, Abraxel. I've heard that name before. He is talking about flood barriers and coastal flooding in Civilization VI Gathering Storm. He says, I've been looking at a strategy for rushing computers in the tech tree, building flood barriers everywhere, then burning as much coal as possible, particularly on maps with a lot of floodable terrain. The results don't seem to be as effective as one would think. Even if the AI's territory is entirely flooded, they don't seem to take any real damage from it. They continue to function. I would have expected it to fall apart, like every city revolting for lack of food or amenities, but they seem to hang on and even trade normally. Maybe there is a slow decline? Any thoughts?
This is a meme build, but it's funny, of course.
I'm guilty of using this strategy, except I don't burn coal at the end. I usually use oil.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the first posters just says it's hit to your yields mostly, but most cities can tank that. Like, they're not good cities anymore, but they don't, like, disband or, like, have their loyalty plummet to the point where they're going to break free unless they're, like, right on the border with a lot of pressure. Okay. So the AI is just going to have less effective production and science and such, but you probably don't really care about that. Like, if you can pull this strategy off, you probably could have just won, so...
Yeah, if you're able to get to computers before postal flooding takes place, you either... are playing on too easy a difficulty, or insert something not insulting here?
Well, no, there's players who can certainly make the research that quickly, too. Like, just blast through it and, like, get super early space wins, even. But then they would do that rather than bothering to, like, flood, like, wait and flood the world.
Yeah. There's no reason.
Or if you don't want to win space, you don't want to do the Chobo victory, you can instead just conquer everything. I'm sure the AI is not going to hold up to any decent tactical control of units that are more advanced than it has. You can beat the AI with, like, contemporary or even dated units relative to it. So if you're, like, running around with a tech lead, I can't imagine it would be that hard to win. But, like, that's not the reason you're doing this in the first place, right? You want to basically watch the world do the opposite of burn, but still not a good thing for the world, and have everyone else suffer while you don't.
Watch the world.
And that's
sing.
Funny. And but if, so from a roleplay perspective, it's amusing, but yeah, don't expect it to be too crushing.
The other problem is building flood walls everywhere is fairly expensive unless you have, I believe it's the city-state of Valletta, which lets you buy things with faith in your town center or ball.
In which case, it becomes almost trivial.
Yeah, but the problem with doing this later in the game is if there's already started to be some flooding, you end up with a situation with, oh, it's getting really expensive because every time the next level of flood comes up, the barriers get more expensive.
And, like, a lot more expensive. It's like they get multiplied or something. It's not just like, oh, they get 15% more expensive or 25% more expensive. It's like, no, they get like 100% more expensive.
Yeah, and if you're building the walls specifically so you can flood the world, doing that is counterproductive because that means you're just reducing your monetary intake by intentionally flooding the world. So my advice is to not do this.
Well, I mean, at that point in the game, like, you're already close enough to the end where, you know, losing money probably doesn't matter all that much.
You're not doing this to improve your position. So if you're doing this at all, I'm not going to recommend against it because you're memeing. So enjoy it, but yeah.
Recognize that it's not an optimal strategy.
Yeah. At a more fundamental level, this does kind of highlight one of the frustrations that I have with the way that Civ 6 does climate change, which is that, like, you can exacerbate it and let it run out of control and not do anything at all to address or mitigate it and, like, still finish and win the game. So, I mean, you can turn the Earth into, you know, a flooded hellhole and, like, still win. And even, like, winning things like diplomatic victories and culture victories and still not just, like, kill everyone else domination victories, but, like, the types of victories that you would think would require, you know, being good stewards of the planet.
I see no problem with this. If you're standing at the top of, like, a flaming husk versus, like, a golden world, you're still standing at the top.
Yeah, but, like, it's frustrating that there's, like, almost no acknowledgement at all within the game that, like, you have dramatically reduced the quality of life of, like, the people that you rule over.
To be fair, you will have a lower score on average if you finish the game that way than if you finish the game other ways, because you are guaranteed to be slower because you've actually left the game long enough for a global warming to take the world into hellhole status. But also, like, if everything is gutted like that, you're going to have less pop and such. So, like, you'll be weaker across metrics. So you'll get a better score if the world is in a good condition when you win.
Yeah, true, but a win is still a win, and like.
Well, sure, but yeah, you're being acknowledged by having a lower score if you.
I suppose, but as we've said so many times on this podcast, like the score in a Civ game is really, really does not matter at all.
Well, victory conditions themselves are arbitrary.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you compare it to something like comparing it to Humankind, where like the score is like everything.
It's the victory condition, which is the main problem with Humankind.
Well, you could actually track score to performance better, and then it wouldn't be as much of a problem.
But the score doesn't represent the best way to play is the problem.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could make a case that the best way to play is the one that optimizes your score. But there are some really broken incentives. I haven't played the games. This is just like what I've heard. That there's like broken incentive / break points. Like you can win while not existing if you had enough score farmed up, but if you get slaughtered fast enough, that's not possible because you won't have accrued enough score.
Right. Yeah, well the idea I think is to make it so that like your like really good performance early in the game and in the middle of the game like counts for more than just setting you up for later in the game. So like I think they're thinking of it kind of like the way we think of, say, for example, the Roman Empire as, being a very, very successful, historical state that like everybody for a thousand years wanted to emulate, even though they did actually, go into decline and fall. So, in Humankind, arguably you can win as the Roman Empire and still fall in the Middle Ages, but still have been the best civilization that had ever existed. Even though you're not the best civilization still in the game when the game ends.
Yeah.
And there's merit to that. Like we can argue back and forth about whether that makes for a good historic, strategy game or not. But like I said, there's a justification for it. And it makes sense.
Yeah, and I'd have trouble arguing too much having not played it. So I haven't experienced the trade-offs or exactly how that's tuned directly.
Yeah, I mean, I've played it.
Like I said, I don't think it's necessarily a problem that score is your driving victory condition. It depends what is contributing to score, because you could have, like, a well-balanced score system, or you could have the opposite, like war participation in Hearts of Iron.
I mean, the scoring system in Humankind, for those listeners who don't know and haven't played the game yet, I would compare it to be kind of a combination of the way that civilization games typically handle score, and also if historic moments that you would get in Civ 6 that are on the timeline, things that you get ERA score for, if those counted for points in your score. It's kind of like a mashup of the two. So you get score for, just having cities and population and controlling territory and like winning battles and stuff like that and having wonders and things like that. But then you also get score for accomplishing certain tasks in game, like being the first to do something in particular, to reach some milestone or threshold, and things like that. And that might include, like, I forget, it's been a while since I played Humankind, so I forget some of the specifics, but I think there are things like circumnavigating the world is something that gives you like exploration points, which, then gets rolled into your score.
Does the game end when somebody's score lead is insurmountable?
No, basically what happens is, if I remember, and it's been a while since I've played, so I don't know if they've changed or updated things, but, what happens is when a civilization gets into the modern era, that basically triggers the end game. And there's like so many turns before, the game ends and whoever has the highest score at that point, which may or may not be the player who triggered the end game, the game would end and then whoever has the most score wins. So kind of like, yes, it accelerates the end of the game because it's not just playing for X number of turns and always playing through X number of turns. It's playing until someone reaches the modern era. And once that happens, that basically begins the countdown towards the end of the game.
Okay. But like if someone has so much score that there are no longer any possible actions that could make up the difference, they should just end the game.
Yeah, that does not immediately end the game, but if you're so far ahead of everyone else that you are triggering, that you're entering the modern era when everyone else is in like medieval or Renaissance era levels of tech and development, then yes, you do end the game faster. And they're not gonna
I just think it's a missed opportunity, like that, to address one of Civ's and other turn-based strategies' major issues, which is having a game that's effectively won, but you can't end it without just smashing in turn a bunch. Like, that is a perfect opportunity to be like, look, this player can no longer be caught, like, mathematically can no longer be caught. It's over, like, period. There's no longer any action that can be taken in the game, not even like a supercomputer taking over for the next best opponent could any longer make up the score differential. At that point, the game is literally over. Just end the game.
Yeah, I suppose hypothetically it could be possible in that game to have a lead that is so large that no other culture in the game could possibly score enough points to catch up to you. That might be possible. But like, there's always like the possibility of, for example, every other, you know, culture in the game ganging up on you and declaring war on you and taking all your cities and destroying your army and all that stuff and, you know, potentially eliminating you from the game.
Yeah,
so,
but from what I understand, if your score is large enough, you would still win.
I would have to like look it up. I was under the impression that you did still have to like be in the game in order to qualify for winning.
Oh, well, in that case, if that's true, then you would just kill anybody who has more score than you in the modern era or near it.
Yeah, you would want to try. But one of the things that prevented that from happening when the game first came out was their weird like war score mechanic that would force like white peace under certain conditions. And like there was no way you could. I had one game where I tried to declare war on another culture in order to prevent them from winning a science victory or whatever. Well, not winning a science victory specifically, but, you know, doing the things that would give them enough points, you know, to win. Like the turn that I declared war on them, the game forced me to end the war with a white piece because somehow their war score was such that I had already lost. And I had no idea how or why. Supposedly that was fixed in a patch at some point, because this was like within a month or two of the game coming out that this happened. And, you know, they patched the war score mechanics several times since then. So hopefully that sort of thing isn't happening anymore. But that was also a big problem when the first game came out, because I know a lot of people were complaining about issues like that, where even though they wanted to, you know, go and conquer this other runaway civ or runaway culture that was winning the game, like the war score mechanic simply would not let them.
Yikes. Well, yeah, that sounds like it wasn't intended. Normally, war score at least is somewhat representative of what happens in the war.
Yeah,
normally.
You would think so, but I don't know what was going on. Like I said, I couldn't figure it out. I was like staring at the points and stuff like that, and I'm like, I don't understand
why.
Yeah,
it's probably bugged.
Yeah, I think it was a bug, and at some point they fixed it, and they made other changes to the war score systems and made changes to the things that you can demand as compensation, you know, after winning a war, because the losing culture has to pay like reparations or whatever to the winning culture and stuff like that. And they've adjusted a bunch because people were frustrated with that because like there was like one thing you could ask for and that would be it. But they changed that to make that more flexible as well. So I haven't played it in a while, so I don't know what the current state of humankind is. But one other subtle thing that I do like about the way that humankind uses score to determine winner, and I'm sorry to have gone off on this big, you know, tangent or whatever, something that I really like about it is that it's not just a winner-take-all system. Like, there is acknowledgement of second place and third place and other runners-up. In fact, the victory screen for humankind shows the top three players, not just the winner.
Interesting.
So I like that even if you're going to lose a game, you can still compete for a second or third place spot, and the victory screen will still acknowledge that. And I like that because it means that, like, you can still, you know, you can still keep playing even if you're not going to be the one and only winning civilization. That's something that you just don't do in Civ. You know, another Civ launches their rocket, and it's just game over. You lose. Your entire civilization crumbles to dust, even if you were two turns away from doing it yourself.
You're reminding me how much I like the Civ 4 system for interrupting a space race.
Mm-hmm.
Once they launch the rocket, you have however many turns until it reaches Alpha Centauri to capture their capital. And if you succeed, it will destroy their rocket, and they'll have to build it again. Now, it's not easy, because the AI usually launches the rocket with like all the techs, so you'll have to fight your way through all the modern equipment that the game allows the AI to produce in probably huge numbers, but it's possible. And I've interrupted victory conditions that way before.
Well, this is just the nuke paradrop system.
Well, you could do that, but, you know, even if you're lagging behind, you can fight your way to it. Sometimes the nuke paradrop isn't practical, because the AI will build SDI, and then, like, a significant percentage of your nukes won't hit. Even if you're firing tactical nukes, ICBMs, you can forget it. It's so unlikely. And those cost so much to build. So it's not always easy to make a whole bunch of subs, put a whole bunch of tac nukes on sufficient to the task, and nuke the city enough, and then have be in paradrop range. Like, this stuff isn't free to manage. But sometimes the AI just has a coastal city, and you can, like, blow it up with battleships or whatever, and then make a run into it. Yeah, it just depends. But you don't want to be too far behind, generally.
Usually by that point, somebody's already won a culture victory.
Well, often the case, you've acted to interrupt that first. Because the AI will shut off its science slider while doing culture in most cases. Well, it has like two culture scripts. And the one where it goes like religious-based culture, it stops like at or before rifles. And the other one, they go out to mass media first. And that one tends to have a bit better defenses. But culture AIs in general tend to suck at defending. So you can just take one of their cities. Or if you take their capital, it breaks the AI script and they go for something else. They stop pursuing that culture victory.
Oh, one minor correction that I want to make for humankind's endgame. It's not entering the modern era that triggers the endgame. It's completing all of the era star requirements for it. So basically, you have to finish the contemporary era, and that triggers the endgame.
Okay, that makes more sense. Well, just conquer whoever's winning, and hopefully the war score thing actually lets you fight wars.
Yeah.
But it probably does now.
Okay, for the next topic, Basil II. This is a little bit of an older thread, but Basil II had a lot of people who were like, oh, he's like super awesome. Ha ha, yay. Let's go kill some Bulgars. And then apparently he is now very unpopular. And we'd like to know, and there's a thread here started by Alex Vance, who moonlights on Civ forums when she's not busy saving the world with Freeman. She says, remember all those YouTube videos when Basil II was spoilered? How insane fun he would be, how easy it would be to win with him, etc. Why did the average player consider Basil to be low to mid tier? Many naysayers focus on Basil II's only arguably weak point, the extreme early game. But a good Basil II player will be taking entire empires with warriors and archers by the classical era. By the time walls are relevant, your Tagma are pulling triple duty as knights, aurobots, and siege weapons. I'm not sure what an aurobot is. Does anybody know what that is?
It's I think when they kill enemy units, they spread religion to nearby cities.
Oh, yeah, he's Byzantium, isn't he? So, yeah, probably. Yeah. You rarely face issues with amenities because of how effective the Hippodrome is at providing them, not to mention free tanks / knights with each Hippodrome plus each upgrade to the Hippodrome, which means that the ability to expand faster without overexpanding, and combining that with the option of winning via religion means you can viably keep 5 allies to boost your trade routes and not have to backstab them in the end.
Yeah, so the basic strategy for Basil in Civ 6 is he has like a feedback loop, positive feedback loop thing going on, where you spread your religion by winning combats and then converting other cities, well, specifically, I think, capitals, then gives all of your units a combat bonus. So you've got that positive feedback loop of spread religion by winning battles and then winning battles because you spread your religion, which is insanely powerful. But the issue with Basil is that all of that is completely contingent on you having had founded your own religion at the beginning of the game. Because if you don't found your own religion, you lose all of those bonuses for the entire game. Because even just having a religion doesn't apply to getting those bonuses. And even capturing other players' holy cities does not, and converting to their religion does not count as you having founded the religion. So I think it's, for a lot of players, they're one of those civs where they're very hit or miss. Either you get that religion and then build a military and steamroll, or you don't get the religion And like you basically are playing a Civ with no unique bonuses at all, pretty much, except for your district that gives you like free cavalry units.
And the Droman, insofar as you care about that. But it will matter on some map.
Now the Droman is pretty good in certain conditions, because the Droman, by winning battles, does you know, spread your faith, because all of your military units do that. And it's a ranged unit instead of the typical melee unit that you would get at that time, the galley or whatever. So yeah. if you can get it behind the lines along their coast and start like using those ranged attacks to take out their units that are like guarding cities and districts and whatever, and convert their capital before you move in your land army, like you get a large military bonus for your land invasion, which can, you know, potentially turn the tide of the war. And if you can sink all, if they have galleys, right, because your units are ranged and theirs are not, you have an advantage in the naval warfare. So if they have a large fleet and you sink it, that's a lot of faith that you're spreading, and probably spreading into like their inner core cities, and, you know, converting them more quickly.
I was just thinking about using it on like more island based maps early to just blow someone up.
Oh yeah, and that works too.
It's always fun to do that.
I do think that they should benefit from their current religion, like whatever that is, as long as they have like the holy site of that religion and have converted to it. That way you're not completely hosed on just losing a religion race early on.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it would be potentially an uphill battle because you would have to conquer that holy city without any of your combat bonuses. But yeah, once you have it, I agree. I do think that it should. And that's even fitting for like, you know, the Byzantine Empire, because it's got like a crusade kind of theme going to it, you know, recapturing the Holy Land kind of thing.
Well, plus, like, they didn't found the religion that they followed. Not right. Really.
But they did own the holy site.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess that kind of depends on you know, what you consider, how you consider founding a schism religion to be, but yeah.
Yeah, well, that's true, but I mean...
Because the Civ 6 does have Eastern Orthodoxy as a separate religion than Catholicism, so...
That's true.
Technically, that is the religion that the Byzantine Empire founded.
I guess.
But the Holy City is still the same.
Right.
The other thing is, like was mentioned in the thread, their very early game is not that impressive, and to be fair, that is the most important spot in any of the Civ games, including 6. Like, for example, friggin' Roosevelt or whatever, America has +4 just out of the gate, like on their home continent. So, like, they already have a stronger bonus than this without bothering with religion at all, and can just go shank somebody immediately. And they're not considered a particularly strong Civ overall.
Yeah, unless America like gets the misfortune of like starting their, you know, capital city being like right on the border, you know, between like two, because, you know, Civ 6 is unique in the civilization games in that continents aren't land masses. A single land mass can be multiple continents. So it's hypothetically possible for America to start on like the border between two continents, and then all their enemies just happen to be on the other quote continent.
Yeah, that's true. It can happen.
And you don't get any bonuses. So
I don't think that's too common though. And of course you can still farm them in your territory to kill their units and then walk over. So you're not like, you still get some benefit, but yeah, I would say I would probably prefer the Byzantine benefit at that point.
Yeah.
Although again, I emphasize, you don't have to found a religion. You don't have to deviate your tech. You don't have to invest in anything off the path of just beating someone down militarily.
Yeah.
They are nowhere near the strongest early game Civ for knocking heads. Nowhere near.
Yeah.
So like your Basil 2 has a nice snowball, but again, like if you are successfully conquering one or two other nations early, other people also have a positive feedback loop. You're just stronger. You have more cities, you have more research, you have more productive capacity to put units up front without sacrificing improving your economy. There's like everybody benefits from growing larger through conquest, period. It's just Basil benefits more quickly and more soundly because his units get better along with everything else due to the religion mechanic. But
right.
Yeah, I mean, everyone gets better, and when you're playing against AI in particular, you don't need to snowball that hard, because once you start snowballing, you're in great shape already.
Yeah, and...
I think, you know, he's fine. I don't think he's top or bottom tier or anything.
Right, and well, that's the whole point of the thread, is during the previews, everyone thought he was going to be, like, super top S tier, and then it's like, okay, I don't know, maybe he's like a B, or a B plus, or something like that. But, yeah, the big issue with Basil is... you compared to other religious oriented civs, like he doesn't start with very many advantages towards founding a religion. So especially on the higher difficulties, and especially if you are playing against other, like, for example, Russia or any civ that has a unique holy site district replacement, it's half the cost. So you get it twice as fast, you know, in the game, and then are you know, creating great profit points that much earlier and founding the religion that much earlier. And I think the only advantage that Baze will get is he gets like one extra great profit point per turn once he has his holy site up and running. But you have to build that holy site and you have to pay full cost for it and you have to research the tech. So, you know, on higher difficulties, it's like, okay, did you find a natural wonder to get the inspiration for it? So the tech is half the cost. No. Okay, well, now it's going to take even longer. You don't have the unique holy site district, so it's going to take twice as long as another, you know, religious civ. And then you actually have to wait for the prophet to actually pop. And, you know, if all the other civs beat you to it, you know, or if like Arabia's in the game and they just are given the last prophet for free, Byzantium is just hosed. Other than, you know, they're just, like I said, just playing a stock civ at that point. Now, you do still have the hippodromes, which give you, you know, some nice amenity bonuses and also free cavalry units, heavy cavalry units. And you can still steamroll the other players with heavy cavalry, especially once they turn into like knights and tanks. You're probably not going to do that much steamrolling with just heavy chariots. But, you know, knights and tanks are powerful units. And if I remember correctly, they're considered free units, which means they have no resource maintenance cost. So, I mean, that's still a pretty powerful buff, even without the religious combat strength bonuses.
It's worth pointing out that if you do flip cities, you can actually use your cavalry to attack cities. They're not gutted like most cavalry was in terms of doing that for Baze.
Right. So by no stretch of the imagination is Baze, like, weak. Even if you don't get the religion, you can still be competitive militarily.
Yeah, he's just... Yeah, he's in the pool of mostly average rulers.
Are we ready for the Senate, or do we want to cut it short?
Ooh, talking about policy cards, huh?
Yeah.
Well, we can talk about it.
How long do you think this conversation will be?
I don't know. I mean, it's the kind of thing where we could talk about it for like 5 minutes, or we could just like drone on for 20. So you can save it for another episode too if you want.
Let's talk about the next topic instead.
Okay.
Who introduces that one?
Oh, is that the Door Monster video?
Yeah. Guess who's back, guys?
Won't be hard to guess now.
Yeah, it's been a while. I don't think they... Did they do any Civilization VI videos? Is this the first one?
The last one they did was in 2019.
Yeah, it's been a while.
But was it a Civ 6 video or was it still a Civ 5 video?
It was a Civ 6 video.
Yeah, okay. They've had Civ 6 videos. Because I remember they had another one using workers early.
Yeah.
Or builders.
Well, the YouTube channel Door Monster is back after a very lengthy hiatus with another entertaining short YouTube clip. It's like, I think, less than 2 minutes long about builders and barbarians and
I push him off the cliff.
Roll.
It started playing when I opened up the thing. That was not good.
Oh, yeah. And about the role that builders may or may not be obligated to play in repairing improvements during active barbarian attacks. Like when the barbarians come, you should probably send all of your civilian units into your cities just in case. And just let them pillage until you can defeat them. I don't know why any Civ 6 player would be sending their builders out. I think what they're doing is they're probably making a mockery of the AI, because that's something that the AI possibly does.
Yeah, the AI still not the greatest.
But anyway, yeah, the video is a builder making an impassioned speech about how it is their duty and responsibility to repair this pillaged tobacco plantation, even though the barbarians are right there waiting to pillage it again.
And nobody seems to care whether they have pillaged resources or not.
And in fact, as a kind of underhanded jab at the obtuseness of some of Civilization VI's mechanics, they even talk about how they have no idea what the tobacco even actually does.
Yeah.
Or why the Empire wants or needs it. which was actually my personal, I found that to be the most amusing part of the video is, oh yeah, you know, there's a lot of very poorly explained mechanics in Civ 6, and amenity is one of them. It's not the worst. The worst is probably culture, victory, and tourism.
Oh yeah. I still don't understand how tourism compares to culture and how they relate to each other. It's weird.
And I've read forums that go over like the math behind it and watched multiple videos. You know, I know Potato McWhiskey, I think, had a good one of a while back. But even after watching that, I'm still like, I don't know. All I know is build more tourism good.
I think that's all that matters at this point. I remember when Culture Victory in Civ 5 was like, build this wonder, was it? You'd finish 5 trees and then you'd build a wonder, I think.
Did you even have to build a wonder?
I thought it was rolling tourism against culture.
Well, that was in Brave New World, but Vanilla Civ 5, you just had to complete 5 of the social policy trees. And then, yeah, there may have been like a wonder or a city project that you had to do after that to actually cement the victory.
Yeah, I don't remember how it was originally.
It was weird.
Well, it was really unsatisfying because it was a super passive mechanic where like you're just accumulating these social policies as you play the game anyway. And then at some point you just trip over a pretty much arbitrary threshold where it's like, oh, would you like to win the game now? And it's like, OK, sure. It would be like if completing the tech tree just won the game for you and you didn't have to do anything else after that.
That would be nice, but no.
Well, the way the victory condition works, well, I don't know, maybe not now that they've added so much more to it, but hypothetically, you could win the science victory without having completed the tech tree.
Yeah.
I think there's a few leaf techs that you don't need to build all the spaceship parts. But if you're that far ahead, you're probably researching all those techs in 2 or 3 turns anyway, so the time it would take you to build the spaceship parts, you would just tech all of those techs anyway.
Yeah,
it was
also
pretty common to win without all the techs in Civ 4.
I remember that
space, that is.
Oh, did we? I remember that when Gods and Kings came out, it was a big deal how all of a sudden you needed all the techs to get to Science Victory, except for the internet, basically.
In Civ 4, you could get pretty far without computers. I think you eventually needed them, but. Oh, and it was generally considered objectively bad to get the space elevator. So far.
Because it costs too much?
Yeah. And you had to deviate in tech to get to it.
Oh, yeah. That would do it.
It was not a required technology for the spaceship itself. And if you had decently productive cities, you could instead just queue up the space parts sooner and come out far ahead, or at least like a few turns ahead of building the space elevator. Like, it was hard. You would have to really engineer like almost insane hypothetical situations to justify deviating your tech and starting like your spaceship engine slower just to put in the space elevator in the queue, such.
Or you just let someone else build the space elevator and then you conquer them or permanent ally with them.
Yeah, well, good luck with that, because the AI doesn't build it quickly either. And if you're letting someone else build that, then you're going to be at risk of losing the space race, and then you might have to go over there and clap them, in which case, why are you bothering with space anymore?
Well, I think you're going to go over and clap them anyway because they have the space elevator.
Yeah, but like with all the investment you took to do that, you could have just like built the ship and launched it and won.
In Civ 4, was it considered good practice to build all of the parts or just go with minimum?
It depended. So you would like go through most of the techs, and then your last one, it depended on your productive capacity, how quickly you could finish multiples of the engine, for example. So you might launch it with a 12 turn versus a 10 turn.
Well, and
there's
also,
no point in like if your productions are going to finish more than one turn apart, then there's no point in building 2 because you won't save any time waiting to launch a 10 turn ship versus just launching a 12 turn ship a couple turns earlier.
Yeah, and if the other civilizations do not pose a military threat to you and they're far enough behind on the tech tree that they're not going to out-tech you to build the other parts, like it kind of doesn't matter because they're not going to capture your capital and they're not going to launch a more advanced, faster spacecraft before yours reaches the destination. But
you would usually build all the thrusters because you would have the tech fast enough.
Yeah, but that, of course, would require making a judgment call on the player's part because you might not necessarily know for sure whether any of those conditions are true.
Yeah.
I found it rare to launch anything but a 10 or 12 turn ship. Maybe I was not optimizing that, though. I didn't go for space too often. I did it sometimes.
I want to say when I played Civ 6, I never played to victory most of the time.
Civ 6, I just knock heads.
It's been a while.
You just kill everything in Civ 6.
I don't think I've played Civ 4 since Civ 5 came out.
The collateral initiative in Civ 4 made like dealing with contemporary or more advanced AI somewhat difficult militarily. You could still do it if you had enough production and you could bait its army and you initiate collateral against it instead, but it's actually dangerous to move into AI territory in Civ 4 at parity, especially on high difficulties, that's true. Whereas like in Civ 6, I found that I could win with tech lead, tech parity, or even like an error behind, as long as I have the Great General, a few policy cards to have good movement, and my stuff is even like a little bit experienced, you just kill the stuff anyway. Because you get like a ton of modifiers between the general and adjacency / surrounding type bonuses and experience upgrades on your units or whatever. You more than overcome the strength differential from a tech gap, which just wasn't a thing in Civ 4. Like, you could put all the promotions on a mace. It wasn't going to be a rifle.
Yeah, I always kind of felt like Civ 4 was more thoughtful in the end game than either Civ 5 or Civ 6, where Civ 5 and Civ 6 just add more micromanagement to the end game to provide an illusion of having, you know, valuable decisions to make. But
I don't know if I would go that far.
Yeah, I mean, it's a broad generalization. I feel like Civ 4, you had to think a lot more carefully about, you know, moving against, you know, another Civ late in the game. Whereas in Civ 5 and Civ 6, I feel like I don't have to think as hard about it. I just have to execute it. You know what I mean?
That makes sense. I just think the mechanics are different enough that the AI struggles in 5 and 6.
And that's a big part of it, too, especially in 6, where the AI tends to stop building units after a certain period of the game. And if they lose those units in the meantime, have nothing to fight back with.
Yeah. Well, that's what makes it so easy to roll over stuff.
In the late game, yeah.
You know how we were talking about these bugs that you were fixing in the Xbox that were causing crashes? Could you, like, make the game fun, too?
A lot of people enjoy the game.
I enjoy the game mostly when I'm feeling mentally up to it, but I don't like how it's just a raffle stomp when you're fighting an AI for the second time. It's like, oh, you didn't bother to build any more units, huh?
Why are you fighting it a second time? Just conquer it the first time.
Sometimes I just run out of steam and I'm just like, okay, I've taken half their empire and all my units are very damaged and it would take me a few turns to wait to heal them up anyway, so might as well just make a temporary piece, and I know they're not going to build any more units, so why bother?
Or it could be that they're just willing to offer so much for peace, especially if it's all lump sum stuff, like, you know, like a thousands of gold or whatever, and maybe a city or two. It's like, okay, fine, I'll just take this, cash it in, and wait 10 turns, and then send my army right back in to take the rest.
I remember the Civ 5 era AI rage quits where you'd have a Civ that you'd take like two cities and they'd offer all 25 of their other cities for peace.
They're just trying to undermine you with the city scaling penalty.
Well, yeah, in Civ 5, that would be a really bad thing to do.
You're pumping them all.
But I forget, would you be allowed to raise those cities if they were given to you in a peace deal, or can you only do that if you conquer it with your military?
I don't remember.
I don't remember either. I suspect you probably could raise them.
Puppet them all.
But if you, I mean, but even
a sprawling empire that does nothing.
Even puppets require happiness, though.
Yeah, that's true.
You just have to accept that you'll never have a golden age ever again.
Oh, it was worse than that in Civ 5 if you did something like that. Like, if you took 20 some cities, like, unless you're like in the late game where you could somewhat manage.
Like, oh, I hope you enjoy that -33% combat penalty on all units.
Yeah, I forgot how punitive it was.
Yeah, it was pretty rough.
The tech penalties for it were awful, too. Ugh.
Yeah, remember?
I definitely liked how in Civ 4 you got to choose how the, you know, extra maintenance and corruption or whatever affected your Civ. You could toggle that gold to science slider. And was there also a culture slider?
There was. You had to unlock it. There was. There's also espionage.
Wasn't there also a luxury slider?
That was culture.
Oh, I thought luxuries and culture were two different things.
Well, they are, but culture affects your happiness. There's no slider for like luxury resources.
Oh, so what you're saying is the cultural advisor was Elvis.
There was no culture advisor before.
Oh, I thought we were talking about Sid too.
Yeah, no, we were talking about four.
Crap. I got derailed on my own brain, apparently.
Yeah, the culture slider in Civ 4, the way that works is that you get like some happiness just for increasing it, and then the amount you get increases in cities that have theaters and coliseums. So you could like build a theater and a coliseum, and then like run your slider at 20% and get a fair amount of happiness out of that in any city that made those investments. But that's a significant investment, and throwing 20% of your commerce into that was a non-trivial cost to pay, but you could offset a lot of unhappiness that way temporarily.
Conquering armies are known for their tendency to build theaters in their wake.
I guess, although you had some other options too.
Caste system being the one I remember.
Also, maintenance was pretty complex because that was like a distance to palace-based calculation. There's also like another maintenance hit for being on a different continent than your home capital, but that maintenance is capped at double your distance to palace, and the communist thing, state property, that made it so that you didn't have a distance to palace penalty. Your maintenance only scaled up based on the number of cities.
So with communism, it was actually good to have cities on other continents.
Yes, somehow.
That makes a lot of...
Yeah.
I'm struggling to put communism and good sense in the same sentence.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you. Games favor command economies generally in a way that just doesn't function outside of games, because the models of games are simpler realities than actual reality. So in a sense, you could justify it.
Well, yeah, games are command economies because you want to give the player control over what their civ is doing. But yeah, in the real world, there's not enough computing power on the planet to simulate and properly handle all of that information and present it in a way that's logical and understandable in an amount of time that's possible to affect.
Like, and then like also you have game options, and you want there to be some incentive to pick game options. And if you didn't make it good, why would anybody ever switch into state property? Well, they wouldn't. But then why include it in the game? They're like, okay, well, we're going to represent this, and we're just going to give it a mechanic so that people have some incentive to pick this sometimes.
It kind of links back to what I was talking about earlier with the climate change, where, you know, the game doesn't care about the quality of life that you're providing, you know, to your citizens all that much, just that, you know, you are controlling territory.
Quality of life, we have an empire to run here.
Right. Yeah, so these are basically just two heads coming from the same problem.
I don't see why it's a problem.
Well, okay, same issue, I guess, maybe not problem, but whatever. The game favors climate change, and the game favors repressive governments because they give more agency to the player at the expense of the supposed quality of life of the little simulated people, which may or may not be living in these little simulated cities.
They're all just a number.
Exactly.
They're not even
just
a number.
Just a statistic.
And it's a super abstract number, because a population point in a city is like, I mean, it's not even measured in like a linear growth. It's like an exponential growth. Like early in the game, each point of population in a city probably represents, what, hundreds, maybe thousands of people?
I think there is a exact correlation in Civ 4. I don't think in Civ 5 or Civ 6, though. Maybe Civ 5. Civ 5 had a demographic screen.
It does, yeah.
Civ 6 doesn't.
Man, those demographic screens were so abusive if you like gamed them.
Oh, I see you've gained another population point.
Like, you could look at the demographics on the first turn and know if, like, Mali was in the game. You could see rushes coming by looking at the score graphs, or the military score. You'd see if someone's building up for a rush. You don't know who necessarily, but you might by inferring other things in there. But, like, if you checked it every turn and you had enough stuff memorized, you could be like, oh, someone produced an Axe Man this turn.
Yeah,
without scouting them.
They probably should have, like, hidden that stuff behind, like, the retire screen until you get to the point in the game where you have like actual relations and maybe some espionage with those other civilizations, kind of like the way that Civ 6 has like the passive espionage things with your allies.
Did a lot more than that.
Maybe the demographics
espionage on someone in Civ 4, you got to see their cities. No, so you could physically observe the units in them without being there.
I'm wondering if it would be interesting for the demographics panel to have hidden information in it until you actually like meet requirements in game to reveal those pieces of information. Unless you just retire and then that's, you know, the game's over. That's all public information. You can see it on the, you know, the retire screen just with all the graphs and stuff.
I'd be fine with that. But I mean, realistically, you don't need it too much either.
I have a quick question.
It's not a thing that has to be in the game because like you're like a lot of it just is scouting. So like once you've scouted somebody, the demographics are just another less immediately useful representation of that same information you've already learned by just looking at their nation.
I have a quick question real quick.
Okay.
How did we get from Dormonster talking about barbarians and warriors to espionage? That's a good question. We'll have
the same way we do this on every episode.
Like, oh, we're talking about one thing, and then it immediately transitions into a whole bunch of other things that are related.
There's a progression.
Or not at all related in some cases.
There's a progression. Just now, give us a little bit of time and we'll take you into the weeds. That's just how it is.
Anyway, hopefully that's something that our listeners enjoy.
I guess we still get listeners after 406 episodes.
It probably makes titling the topics a little questionable, but other than that.
Well, you don't title the topics so much. You just call it what the link is, and then anything that comes out of that is fair game.
I know when I was writing the stuff for the website, if we did go on like a crazy tangent that was like became a totally different topic, I would at least try to acknowledge that in the description. But yeah, it was tough sometimes because it would require like listening to the entire episode again.
You think I do that when I edit? No way.
Yeah, it depends on how much time you have available or how quickly after the recording you do it and how much of it is still fresh in your memory.
I mean, after this I'll have to edit 6 episodes to be caught up. But hey, they're actually coming out now, so that's good.
Are you still planning on a 1 or 2 per week timeline?
Monday and Friday until they are all out. Maybe I'll release this one next Saturday just to... No, because then they'll be out of order and that'll confuse people.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is completely irrelevant to people who will be listening in the future, so I'll skip it for later. This has been Polycast episode 406. I'm Canis Albinus. I'm here, finally back in working condition, mostly. And I'm joined with the Mian team.
You can leave your workers outside your city. I'll protect them for you.
And Mega Bears fan.
Woohoo! It's football season again. Our long national nightmare is over.
It's a lot better than Watergate. Is that the exact quote that happens in every Madden game in preseason?
It is, yes. The first preseason game in Madden, they call it the 6-month national nightmare or something like that. Yeah. I'm surprised you knew that.
Well, there are quite a few people who, I used to watch somebody who you would stream Madden every time the new Madden came out. They would do like a 4-season emulated season type thing where they would play as the Jets. So you can imagine how well that went.
They
always complain about that line. Because he's like, oh, well, they have the strangest narrative lines. They're always talking about how it's always better than Watergate. And people had to remind him that the reason it does that is because it's a fairly famous quote from a football person.
I don't think I've ever heard the Watergate line. But yeah, the opening kickoff of the first preseason game in every season in Madden, they talk about the long national nightmare finally being over. But yeah, I don't remember any commentary in the game ever referencing Watergate.
Well, because the long national nightmare was the Watergate trial stuff.
Oh, originally. Okay, yeah.
That's where that reference comes from. And that's why they say, well, it's a lot better than Watergate, because that's where it's related. Anyway, gotcha. We're supposed to be wrapping up a podcast here.
And thank you for listening to the last 2 minutes of Maddencast.
Okay, they're used to it by now. I mean, your name is Mega Bears Fan. What do they expect?
Yeah, it's right there in the name, in the logo.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure teams are not looking too good for this upcoming season.
would be fine, but I don't think we have Super Bowl contenders here.
Civilization 3, 4, 5, Beyond Earth, and 6 Sound Clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright The Polycast at thepolycast.net.